The highly questionable designation of Mexican and Venezuelan gangs as terrorist groups is in keeping with a Latin America policy under Trump that portrays every undesirable situation as a threat to national security, thus justifying illegal U.S. actions. Those actions include the demand that Brazil abort its trial of coup leader Jair Bolsonaro or face 50% tariff rates, the deportations to El Salvador, the ongoing embargo against Cuba, and the $50 million bounty for the arrest of Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro. These latest threats of invasion reveal a purely negative and aggressive Latin America policy that will provoke angry receptions in much of the region, where fears of the Colossus of the North remain very much alive. Trump may be bluffing here. His pursuit of a Nobel Peace Prize might be worth more than bombing a drug cartel. But with his economic policies in deep trouble and the Epstein affair not going away, I think it's entirely possible that he will act impulsively in Mexico. The politics of distraction is already well underway, never mind that Mexico's cooperation on migration and the drug cartels has been effective. Until Trump's directive, its officials reportedly believed that relations with the U.S. were on the upswing. The U.S. ambassador to Mexico, Ronald Johnson, said in July that the greatly reduced drug flow and border crossings were, quote, due to a secure border and increased collaboration between the U.S. and Mexico, unquote. That collaboration will vanish with an invasion. If the U.S. does this without Mexico's consent, it will set the relationship back 100 years, said Todd Robinson, who was the Assistant Secretary of State for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs in the Biden administration. Mexicans should know better than to count on a U.S. president who is oblivious to facts and has no problem reversing policy on a dime. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem, James Kemp, and Mel Gertoff. The producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Catherine Carley, Antonia Gonzalez, Isabel Charlet, and Dr. Anthony Lysowitz. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. Today, we're talking birds. Are they real? Just kidding. I'm delighted to be joined today by Rebecca Heisman, freelance journalist and the author of Flight Paths, how a passionate and quirky group of pioneering scientists solved the mystery of bird migration. Flight Paths is a fascinating and engaging deep dive into the history and science of bird migration research and how understanding bird migration matters for effective conservation efforts. My email box is always open at coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Drop me a line with show ideas, guest suggestions, scathing criticisms, or whatever. Coast Range Radio is free on all podcast apps. We're also proud to be aired on community radio stations throughout the Pacific Northwest. And please support those community radio stations and your public media in general. Okay, let's get to the interview. Rebecca Heisman, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Thank you for having me.
I just finished your book last night, actually, and I learned so much. And as somebody who would like to someday call himself a birder, it was a great read, and I can't wait to talk with you about it. I was hoping that you could start us off with a reading from Flight Path.
Sure. So this is from the beginning of chapter 4. On the morning of May 13th, 1973, a Swainson's thrush, pausing on its journey from its winter home to its summer home, blundered into a mist net in east central Illinois. The researchers who gently pulled it from the net went through all the usual rituals, weighing and measuring it, clasping a numbered metal band around its leg, but they added one unusual element, a tiny radio transmitter weighing just 0.005 of an ounce. They carefully trimmed the feathers from a small patch on the bird's back, then used eyelash glue to cement the transmitter mounted on a bit of cloth in place against the bird's skin. When the thrush was released, it probably shuffled its feathers a few times as it got used to its new accessory, then returned to resting and foraging in preparation for continuing its trek. At only around 3% of the bird's total body weight, the transmitter wouldn't have impeded the bird noticeably as it went about its daily routine. Then, around 8:40 that evening, after the sun had dipped far enough below the horizon that the evening light was beginning to dim, the thrush launched itself into the air, heading northwest. It would have had no way of knowing that it was being followed. An electrical engineer named Bill Cochran had been waiting nearby in a converted Chevy station wagon with a large antenna poking out of a hole in the roof. When the thrush set out into the evening sky, Cochran and a student named Charles Welling were following on the roads below. All they could see in the deepening night was the patch of highway illuminated by their headlights, but the sound of the wavering beep, beep, beep of the transmitter joined them to the thrush overhead as if by an invisible thread.
Beautiful. Thank you for that. There's so much interesting science, and I will say you tell it in a really engaging way. So actually, before we go any further, where can people find the book?
Wherever you like to buy your books. I always encourage people to buy it through a local independent bookseller if they can, but it's on, you know, Amazon and all those sorts of places too.
So since this is a really conservation-minded podcast, why is understanding bird migration important? And I'm wondering if you could talk about maybe some of the surprising or non-intuitive reasons that listeners should care about birds and migration beyond just if you love birds. I mean, that too.
Yeah, well, as far as why it's important to understand bird migration, I think it started, you know, with early ornithologists just with curiosity. And I think a lot of people still just find the idea of these animals making these extremely long journeys to be inspiring. But from a conservation perspective, it's important to understand bird migration because for these birds that migrate long distances, migration is the most dangerous part of their life. They're more likely to die during migration than they are on their wintering grounds or on their breeding grounds. So if we want to be able to address and turn around the long-term declines that we're seeing in bird populations around the world, understanding the routes that birds take on migration, the stopover habitats they're using, and the threats that are affecting them during that time is a really crucial piece of it, and a piece that can be kind of hard to study because it's, you know, when they're on their breeding grounds, you can go out and just watch them, but you don't necessarily know where they are when they're moving in between. So that's what this book is about how we're trying to fill in that piece of the puzzle and the techniques that we're using to do it.
Right. Throughout the course of your book, you really show how it's not, I mean, for a non-migrating species or for an old growth forest, you need to protect that habitat, right? But with migrating birds, there's the breeding area, there's the migration area, there's the wintering area. There are all of these different pieces that are disparate, but so connected. Speaking of the conservation piece, one of my favorite parts of the book was learning about what's called the birdcast and some of the other conservation-focused research. Could you talk a little bit about what birdcast is and why it is?
Yeah, birdcast is this really cool forecasting tool from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, where during migration, you can log onto their website and get a forecast for how many birds are going to be passing over your area that night. Most migrating songbirds migrate at night, and how many of them are in the air on a given night depends on factors like the weather. So there's big nights and quiet nights, and this is a tool that will tell you whether or not it's going to be a big night in your area. And it's actually based on data from weather radar, because there's a whole chapter about this in my book. Birds show up really well on weather radar. So it's a really good tool for gathering sort of large-scale data on bird migration. But where the conservation piece comes in with BirdCast is there's a really big effort to use it to try to encourage people and like owners of big buildings and big cities to shut off the lights in these tall buildings on nights when it's going to be a really big, heavy bird migration night, because we don't really understand why this happens, but night migrating birds are attracted to artificial light, and so they can fly into city lights and become disoriented and be killed. So BirdCast is part of an effort to turn that around, to stop that from happening.
Yeah, that was so fascinating. And I'm hoping in a little bit we'll talk more about the different methods that you profile and actually some of the amazing characters in the book as well. But first, could you talk about, because you talked about BirdCast and kind of the point, the idea behind it, and the ideas in the book about, well, if we know where these migrating birds are going, if we know where the bottlenecks are, then we know where we need to focus conservation efforts. But you also talked about the difficulty in translating that science into concrete action or conservation success stories. And actually, you did have this a really great section in the book. I was wondering if you could read that section again, and then we could talk about that.
Yeah. We know more now than we ever have before about where migratory birds go and when and what threats they face along the way as a result, thanks to the techniques described in this book and the tireless efforts of the researchers who've developed, refined, and applied them. But it's surprisingly hard to find concrete examples of new information on the migration patterns of a specific species leading directly to better on-the-ground conservation. Stories like that are out there, and the ones that do exist are striking. When I talked to British ornithologist Nigel Clark about his efforts to track endangered spoon-billed sandpipers by satellite, he described officials in China quickly taking down nets and putting up warning signs at a newly identified stopover site. Earlier in the 1990s, satellite transmitters let researchers follow mysteriously declining Swainson's hawks to their wintering grounds in South America. There, they found large numbers of them dying after exposure to the pesticide Monocrotophos, I might have said that wrong, and multiple countries soon made a plan to ban the use of the pesticide in areas important to the hawks. More recently, land was added to a nature preserve to protect a patch of northern Colombia that geolocators had shown was especially important to prothonotary warblers, and a coalition of countries agreed to work toward protecting a newly identified hotspot for seabirds in the northern Atlantic. But I'd expected to find dozens of these examples, and instead came up with only a handful.
Thank you for that. That really encapsulates a lot of what I wanted to ask you about on this subject. But why do you think that, with all of this amazing science that you profile in Flight Paths, why is it so hard to translate that into these concrete success stories?
It's a huge issue, I think, not just with migrating birds, but with conservation in general. There's definitely a big disconnect between the people going out and doing research and the people in government making rules about how we apply that research for conservation. And often there's even a big disconnect between the people doing the on-the-ground research and the people doing the on-the-ground wildlife management. Those are two different career paths that surprisingly often don't communicate with each other that well, even though you would think they would be pretty similar. So part of it is just information siloing. You know, researchers are publishing their findings in academic journals that are often behind a paywall, which if you don't know how to get around that paywall, you might not have any way of reading this information. And, you know, if you're working for some little nature preserve, your, you know, nonprofit employer probably can't afford subscriptions to these fancy academic journals. And then at the government level, you know, there's so many there's the politics, there's so many competing needs that need to be balanced, there's funding. And so it's one thing to like, okay, now we've identified this threat, and then getting the funding and the political will and the knowledge on the ground needed to fix it is a whole separate thing.
Yeah, very well put. And as a just a side note, I hate all those academic journals keeping all this great content behind paywalls. It's very unfortunate for those of us without the budgets of universities. But that may be a different conversation, unless you want to expound on that. I also think one of the issues, and I'm wondering as a journalist what you think about this, is that siloing can happen also with like activism and research. Knowing a lot of activists and organizers, a lot of folks are trying to read this research, but I feel like a lot of researchers and scientists feel very constrained in how they can speak about things. Have you noticed that? Or do you think that's changing at all, especially in this political climate?
I know the kind of culture that you're referring to within academia, but I do think it's changing. It's obviously each individual person is different, but I do think more and more researchers are becoming comfortable speaking out on, you know, making judgments about things instead of just presenting facts. And the slippery slope there is that's why some people claim not to trust scientists is, well, you know, this, then you can say, well, this is just your opinion then, but, and so then you might not know where the facts start and the opinion stops. And so that's why some scientists are very, very cautious about doing that. But I think more scientists are coming around to the idea of being advocates as well as researchers.
Yeah, such a good point. And I totally empathize with the researchers and scientists who you know, want their work to be able to speak for itself and not get politicized. It's a really hard position to be in. But we're all in a really hard position right now, so there's no easy choices. I wonder if you could talk about some of your favorite characters or scenes from the book, and those could be some of the human characters like Bill Cochran, or, you know, your sections on the Swainson Thrush really get to me because we have so many of them coming in early summer, and that's really been kind of a window for me into deepening my appreciation for birds.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Bill Cochran, and he was mentioned briefly in the excerpt that I read at the beginning. He was definitely one of my favorite researchers that I learned about in the whole book. And for anyone who's familiar with wildlife telemetry, putting radio transmitters on wildlife and really any sort of wildlife, not just birds, Bill Cochran was sort of the guy who first figured out how to do it and made it practical. And he had some really wild adventures in like the 60s and 70s and 80s, like following birds back and forth across the country, sometimes in his station wagon that I referenced before, sometimes in airplanes, tracking radio tag birds on migration. And the amazing thing was he passed away a few years ago, but he was still alive when I was working on my book. So I did get to interview him and visit him in his home and get to know him a little bit, which was really fantastic. And then, yeah, that whole chapter really is my favorite chapter in the whole book because I focus on Swainson's thrushes throughout the chapter on radio telemetry. And it came together so nicely because it turns out that there are people still using the current generation of radio transmitter technology to study Swainson's thrushes. So in that chapter, I was also able to weave in the story of this woman from Colombia named Ana Gonzalez, who is using today's generation of radio telemetry to study the same thrushes from the Colombia, the South America end of their migration. And so those two stories came together and intersected really well, even though there were two very different people from two very different time periods kind of looking at this same bird using this same technique.
Yeah. Yeah, it really made me want to know where my little Swainson thrushes are going in the winter, or if they come back to our yard and all of that. And yeah, some of those stories that you have in there about Bill Cochran are pretty awesome. And I'm glad that you got to meet him as part of that work. So like I was just kind of mentioning, I'm not really a birder and definitely very far from a bird nerd, but I've become more and more interested in birds over the past couple years, partially with a lot of help from the Merlin Bird app, which I think is great. And so I've started dipping my toes in that world. So I'm wondering what got you into birds and birding, and if you have any advice for someone like me who wants to learn more about the birds around me but is intimidated by the world of birding.
Well, I love Merlin, so if you're a Merlin user, I think you're already off to a great start. For anyone who's not familiar with Merlin, this is this amazing free phone app where, among other things, it will identify, they will use the microphone on your phone to identify the songs and calls of birds around you in real time, and I use it all the time, too. I think it's fantastic. Yeah, I've been interested in birds ever since my parents put up a bird feeder in the backyard during the winter when I was a kid. My parents were not bird watchers, but they just did that for fun, and I was fascinated by it. And then it wasn't really until I went off to college that I met other bird watchers and got really involved in bird watching or birding as a hobby. And yeah, at one point I wanted to be an ornithologist and, you know, do science on birds myself, and then figured out that I actually enjoy learning about and talking about and writing about other people's research more than I like having to do the research myself.
Yeah.
But yeah, advice for anyone who wants to get interested in birds. I mean, it's easy because there's there's birds everywhere, right? You don't really even need binoculars. You can start by just paying attention to the birds you see that in your backyard and that you see while walking around your neighborhood, and you know, looking them up on Merlin. And I bet there's, if you haven't paid attention to birds before, I bet there's way more species around than you would think that you can identify even just doing that.
That is what I've found. And you know, I know that some of my more nerdy bird friends are like Merlin, but they're like, but you shouldn't use it too much. But it's been an invaluable tool for me, just because otherwise I would have no idea how to even start with identifying beyond like the few ones. But yeah, the ability of that app to identify bird sounds, even when there's like 10, 15 different birds singing at the same time, is just incredible. But that aside, that free advertisement for that app aside, are there any other pieces, because I want to get to some of your other journalism, are there any other pieces of the book that you really want to highlight?
Oh, another favorite section of mine is probably the one on moon watching, because this is this sort of obscure, kind of obsolete technique, but it's so fascinating that before we had radio transmitters, this guy from Louisiana, George Lowry, working in the 1940s and 50s, came up with a way to measure and quantify bird migration by looking at the full moon through a telescope, because remember, a lot of these birds migrate at night, and just counting the silhouettes of birds passing in front of the full moon, and then doing some math to standardize that and turn it into a usable measurement of bird migration traffic. And so that there's some wild stories that went into that as well.
Yeah, it's just amazing the dedication that some of these, especially amateur folks, have to this cause. And again, before we get off the subject of your book, Flight Paths, I just want to appreciate how you weave together all of these different approaches that researchers have taken to studying these issues, and how a lot of them overlap in really complementary ways and in surprising ways that folks never would have thought that they would have. So for anybody that's not just into birds, but into conservation, into good science writing, I definitely recommend Flight Paths. I do want to bring us back into the politics, though, unfortunately. So you are also a freelance journalist, and not that long ago you wrote an article that I believe was entitled Trump versus Birds, or did I get that wrong?
I think that's the title it ended up running with. I didn't write the title.
Okay, okay.
Something some people don't know about journalism is that it's often editors who write the headlines, not the journalists.
Yeah, yeah. Fair. We'll talk about that article, though, and I'm curious, A, what you were talking about there, and then how that ended up shaking out.
Yeah, well, two of the bird migration research programs that I cover in the book are bird banding, which is where we put these numbered metal bands around the sort of ankles of humanely captured birds to track their movements if they're caught again later, and specifically the bird banding lab, which oversees and does all the permits for bird banding in the United States and is actually part of the USGS, the United States Geological Survey. And then another program also housed at the USGS called the Breeding Bird Survey, which is where volunteer bird watchers go out and actually drive routes along roads every spring and pause at regular intervals to collect data on the birds that they can see and hear, which has been going for decades and decades now and provides some of really our only long-term data on bird population trends in North America, whether populations are going up or down. And so what prompted me to write that article is that the section of the USGS that houses both of those programs, the Trump budget proposal basically proposed completely eliminating the budget for that part of the USGS, completely getting rid of it, firing all the people who work on those programs. And so I'm not a political journalist. This was kind of outside my wheelhouse, but I ended up writing this piece just for people who might not be familiar with these kind of obscure government research programs, just trying to lay out what they do and why they're so important, talking to some ornithologists who use them and talking about what we would lose if they're eliminated, which would be a really devastating loss for this field and for bird conservation in general.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the time we're living in, where you can't, if you love anything in this world, you can't avoid the politics of it. Do you know what happened with that? Did they zero out the budget in that bill?
I don't think it's been decided yet. I could be wrong about this because, again, I'm not a political journalist, but my understanding is that that specific proposal was not part of the so-called Big Beautiful Bill. So I think as of now, it's still that budget is still just a proposal, if that makes sense. But that's kind of what the Trump administration has said that they want to do for the annual budget.
Oh, thank you for that clarification. I was under the impression that that was part of that bill. Do you know? I know. Go ahead.
I was going to say that bill was sort of part of the budget proposal, but it wasn't the whole thing, as I understand it. Like that was not, you know, that bill was kind of separate from setting the whole federal budget for the next year.
Got it. Okay.
I think.
And I know that you're not an advocate, but do you know, it's okay if not, but do you know like where folks might go to A, find that article? Where do you recommend that people go to find that article? And B, you know, is there action that people can take there to let the feds know what they think about that?
Yeah, so the article was published at an online publication called The Revelator, which is published by the Center for Biological Diversity. So you can probably find it by going to therevelator.org and doing a search for Trump versus birds. It's old enough now that it's not on their homepage anymore. And yeah, I guess the best thing you could do would be to call your senators and representatives and say that you care about bird research and don't want those programs to go away. I'm becoming more cynical by the day about how effective it really is to call one's representatives, but that's the best I can come up with right now.
Yeah. Yep. Sadly, the ones in power listen to one man and one man alone, and the ones out of power don't have much. But, you know, whether your representative is a Republican, you know, it still helps to let them know what people care about. And if your representative is a Democrat, then they need to know what, you know, what our priorities are moving forward. So, you know, it's one of those things where sometimes the act of doing it is a good in and of itself, whether or not you get the desired action. That's my hopeful take on it. But yes, I share your, I wouldn't say cynicism, but skepticism. I want to follow two of those threads. So first of all, though, where do people find your other writing? You have a Substack, right?
It's not on Substack anymore. It's on a different email service. But yeah, if you go to my website, RebeccaHeisman.com, just my first name, last name.com, I have a page on there that I keep updated with all of my various freelance writing, or even easier, on the homepage of that website, you can sign up for my monthly email newsletter, which is just goes out once a month, and it's free, and it has things that I'm writing and cool bird news from elsewhere and book recommendations and stuff like that. So if you like birds and science and books, it might be something to look at.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed reading through your newsletters, especially as somebody who a lot of what I consume is political. A lot of your stuff is a little more fun to read. So but on that, back on that political front, or maybe not, just conservation in general, are there other stories that are maybe underreported that conservationists and climate folks should be tracking or paying attention to, in your view? Could be good news, bad news.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind when we talk about birds, I mean, climate change gets all the attention, and with good reason. Climate change is a huge existential threat. But when we're talking about these long-term declines in bird populations that we've been seeing for decades now, climate change is not the major driver of that. And that might shift, you know, kind of starting now and into the future, where climate change might be more of the cause of the declines that we're seeing. But really, looking back at the declines that are already happening, the big drivers of that are, for one thing, habitat loss, and then all, which is separate from climate change. Mm-hmm. And then also for birds in particular, some of the biggest sources of mortality for birds in North America are outdoor cats and collisions with windows. So, and no one really thinks about those. No one talks about those. So there are, if you're specifically interested in bird conservation, some of the biggest killers of birds are things that most people are not thinking about and talking about.
Yeah. Well, that's going to be, that last one's going to be controversial with my wife about kitties, but no, I'm mostly joking. Yeah, I know that one's a big one. A lot of big opinions about that. The windows, not quite so controversial, for sure. Well, is there anything that we've missed or anything else you want to make sure that we include in the conversation today?
I don't think so. I think we've pretty much covered it.
Well, great. I would love for you maybe to give one last plug for where folks can find your book and your journalism work, and then maybe you could end us with one last reading from the book.
Yeah, so you can find me at RebeccaHeisman.com, and from there you can find my, you know, various social media accounts and email newsletter and all that stuff. And my book is Flight Paths, and you can find it wherever you like to buy books, or probably at your local public library too. And so to close out, I'm just going to read the last couple paragraphs from the book. Yeah, here we go. The week after I went birding with Bruce Taves, I returned to the lake by myself on a quiet Friday morning. I couldn't see the water from the parking lot, but when I got out of my car, I heard a loud racket of unfamiliar bird calls coming from that direction. Those aren't Canada geese, I thought. Maybe snow geese? My birding by ear skills are still, shall we say, in development. I immediately started working my way along a trail to get a view of whatever birds were making all the noise. The morning sun was in my eyes, but I could make out a flock of perhaps 50 large white birds on the water. Snow geese it was then, a fairly common species here in winter and during migration. But then their calls reached a crescendo, and all at once they lifted off, coming straight toward me, the beating of their wings adding to the din. As they approached, I got a better look and realized what I was seeing. Not geese, swans. The flock of tundra swans wheeled as one until they were pointed north, then disappeared over a rise. In May, those birds would be raising babies on the shores of the Arctic Ocean. I don't know what the next year or the next decade or the next century holds for their descendants or for mine, but I do know that all over the world, in Colombia and Mongolia and the Netherlands and here in my own community, scientists, bird watchers, and activists of all sorts are dedicating themselves to making sure that migratory birds will continue to be here, continue to knit the globe together with their journeys, and continue to bring hope to all who see them.
Beautiful. That's a great place to leave it. So, Rebecca Heisman, thank you so much for joining me on Coast Range Radio, and thank you so much for your book and for your work.
Yeah, thank you. This was fun.
That's it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. Coast Range Radio is an independent production. If you like the show, please help me grow the audience by telling your friends about it, following Coast Range Radio on Instagram, or best of all, directly share it with at least two people by texting the link to our podcast feed. If you don't know how to do that, or for any other reason that you might want to reach out and say hi, the show email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Like I say, reach out anytime. Thank you so much for